Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Aisha Wahab. I believe, as Celia mentioned, I'm a board member of the Afghan Coalition as well as the former chair of the Alameda County Human Relations Commission. At the same time, I've been to Afghanistan in 2014 during the most recent election as part of the peace delegation. I will be your moderator for today's program called Resolving Afghanistan and Crafting a Sensible U.S. Approach. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Anthony Alfidi. Anthony is a private investor in San Francisco. He is also an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army Reserve, currently holding the rank of lieutenant colonel. He has performed military duty in South Korea, Kuwait, Germany, Iraq, and most recently in Afghanistan. He plans to give his personal views of why U.S. policy has not achieved peace in Afghanistan and how the new administration should pursue reforms. He will speak only for himself as a private citizen and that his opinions will only affect him. No way is he speaking as an official position of the U.S. government. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It is always a privilege to speak at the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Anthony Alfidi, and I am here to share my thoughts on how to resolve the conflict in Afghanistan. As Aisha mentioned, I served in Afghanistan as a U.S. Army officer from 2016 to early this year, and I currently serve in the U.S. Army Reserve as a lieutenant colonel, specializing in intelligence, although I am not on active duty at the present time. You may notice that I have even allowed my hair to grow long to present a distinctly unmilitary appearance. That's how I like it when I'm in civilian status. I will not discuss my specific duties in Afghanistan, but suffice it to say that I provided material support to both the U.S. counterterrorism mission under Operation Freedom Sentinel and to the NATO-led coalition's advisory mission under Operation Resolute Support. I received permission from my military superiors before I departed Afghanistan to share my opinions in public, subject to the following two caveats. First, I will only ever discuss unclassified material that the United States government or international organizations or academics have already officially approved for public release. Secondly, I am speaking only in my capacity as a private citizen, and the personal views and opinions I will express do not reflect in any way the official positions of the United States government or the active policies of any government agency, including the Department of Defense. Having said all that, I want to describe what I personally think is needed to conclude the conflict in Afghanistan on terms that are favorable to the United States and to the people of Afghanistan. I will first describe the progress of the war in recent years, particularly since the NATO-led mission transitioned from active combat to training and advisory at the end of 2014. I will also describe how outside actors, particularly Pakistan, continue to inhibit a peaceful end to the war. I will then describe how policy recommendations from various U.S. government reviews would improve the conduct of the war. And finally, I will offer a new U.S. strategy towards South and Central Asia that can mitigate malignant influences from outside Afghanistan. So let's start with a review of the war, briefly, since 2014. The NATO-led effort transitioned in 2014 from an active combat mission under ISAF to a training and advisory mission under Resolute Support, with a much more limited scope intended to move Afghan national defense and security forces into the lead in the fight against the Taliban. The results since then have been somewhat discouraging. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, a U.S. government body, generates a constant stream of public reports detailing U.S. money misspent on the lack of progress in Afghanistan. SIGAR's most recent quarterly report to Congress from April 2017 tells the sad tale in numbers. The U.S. has spent over $117 billion since 2002 on military and economic aid to Afghanistan, not including the cost of our own deployed forces. This is just aid to the Afghan government. The result of this investment is a perennially weak Afghan government and an Afghan military that is unable to secure the entire country. The government of Afghanistan officially controls or influences only about 66% of the population and about 59% of the local government centers. The rest is either contested or under direct Taliban control. The province of Helmand is a particular disappointment, with most of the province under Taliban control or influence. The recent loss of Helmand's Sangin district center to the Taliban this past March is a particular blow to the U.S. and NATO, as more American and British service members died fighting for Sangin than in any other Afghan district. The failure of the U.S.-led counter-drug mission in Afghanistan is just as stark as the disappointment of the counterinsurgency campaign. According to SIGAR's latest data, the U.S. has spent $8.5 billion since 2002 in an interagency effort to eradicate opium production in Afghanistan. Today, Afghanistan produces about 80% of the world's opium crop, feeding the heroin addictions of millions of people in Europe and Central Asia. Opium revenue provides the Taliban with 60% of its funding, according to the U.S. military. Eradicating opium production completely would, of course, undercut the Taliban's ability to fight, but it would also severely harm the Afghan economy without introducing substitute crops. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime noted in its 2016 Afghanistan Opium Survey that the Afghan government's poppy eradication efforts declined significantly in 2016. Kabul officials are very aware that the drug economy is an inescapable part of the nation's economy. The drug economy contributes to Afghanistan's governance problems through the influence of corrupt local officials who would rather take bribes or collaborate with the Taliban than work for justice. The U.S. has made strengthening Afghanistan's capacity to govern itself a priority since the 2014 transition from active combat to advisory. Once again, the results are discouraging. Afghanistan ranks 169th out of 176 countries in the Corruption Perceptions Index, published annually by Transparency International, a watchdog group tracking government corruption worldwide. It ranks 163rd out of 180 countries in the Heritage Foundation's annual Index of Economic Freedom, with special note of Afghanistan's underdeveloped financial system limiting the effectiveness of monetary policy. Finally, the World Bank ranks Afghanistan 183rd out of 190 countries in its Doing Business Index, with particular weaknesses in construction permitting, property registration, investor protection, and contract enforcement. In fairness, Afghanistan was not even ranked in Heritage's index until 2017, primarily due to poor data quality, in my opinion, and it was not even a member of the World Trade Organization until 2016. So there has been some progress in Afghanistan's ability to connect with the global economy. The World Bank published its first ever Doing Business report on Afghanistan in 2017, noting that reform-minded policymakers can make speedy progress by adopting some subnational best practices at the national level. I must say that of the total $117 billion amount of U.S. assistance I mentioned above, over $32 billion of that total was focused on development assistance. That $32 billion is a lot to pay to barely move the needle on governance and corruption over 15 years. Now let's address Pakistan's malignant role. We must ask ourselves why, after over a decade and a half of focused help from the U.S. and major developed nations, Afghanistan is still plagued by violence and unable to solve permanently its governance problems. I think we need only look due east of Afghanistan to find a major contributor to the problem. Pakistan has played a spoiling role in Afghanistan's affairs for decades and has played a particularly counterproductive role in Afghanistan's affairs since the beginning of the U.S. intervention in 2001. Afghanistan's refusal to accept the existing internationally recognized border with Pakistan has long been a sore point for Islamabad. The British Empire reached an agreement with Afghanistan in 1896 to draw the Afghan-India border through historically Pashtun tribal areas, along a line known as the Durand Line, named after its British surveyor. Afghanistan's Pashtun rulers since the 19th century have never disguised their intent to eventually recover control of the entirety of Pashtun lands, sometimes known as Pashtunistan, which would, of course, pose a mortal threat to Pakistani sovereignty. Pakistan's support for movements that destabilize Afghanistan is a blatant reminder to Kabul that it shall have no influence in Pakistan's own tribal areas. Pakistan has similarly had contentious relations with its larger neighbor to the east. Pakistan views India as an existential threat and deploys most of its conventional combat forces to deter potential military action by India. Its nuclear arsenal serves a similar function, guaranteeing the survival of the Islamabad government. Pakistan views Afghanistan as a theater to achieve strategic depth in its rivalry with India, and seeks a compliant Afghan government that is at best no threat to Pakistan's own stability and offers no strategic opening to India. Pakistan's intelligence arm, the Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, certainly has a history of supporting militant movements. Active ISI involvement with precursors of the Taliban dates to the 1980s, when the ISI used U.S. aid to build Mujahideen fighting movements that opposed the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. This was U.S. policy at the time. The ISI maintained some form of influence with the Pashtun factions of these fighters as they eventually evolved into what became the Taliban after the Soviets departed Afghanistan in 1989. I refer to C. Christine Fair's book, Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, as an excellent description of Pakistan's military doctrine. Based on primary source material published by the Pakistani military, Fair's work supports the idea that deterring India and exporting instability from its Pashtun tribal areas is part and parcel of Pakistan's national self-concept. It is unclear from open source reporting whether Pakistan's ISI still actively collaborates with or directs the Afghan Taliban. English language media in Afghanistan is full of accusations of Pakistani complicity in facilitating the Taliban's continued existence. Similar English language media in Pakistan will sometimes obliquely mention the Pakistani military's history of corruption and incompetence, implying that they compensate for their domestic shortfalls by sponsoring violent movements disrupting Afghanistan and India. The continued presence of the Taliban's senior leadership within Pakistan's Pashtun belt, specifically the Quetta Shura in Balochistan and safe havens for the Haqqani network in the tribal areas, is an indictment of Pakistan's duplicity. We do not need to see a smoking gun of ISI active support for Taliban and Haqqani violence to know that those groups could not conduct their insurgency without maintaining an unchallenged refuge within Pakistan. There are some new developments with Afghan refugees with potentially alarming consequences. In the past 12 months, Pakistan has announced the forced repatriation of Afghan refugees living in Pakistan. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and the International Organization for Migration have estimated that at least 600,000 Afghan refugees were repatriated from Pakistan in 2016. The UNHCR further estimates that up to 3 million refugees will return to Afghanistan from all expatriate locations in 2017, not just Pakistan. Human Rights Watch has monitored Pakistani abuse of Afghan refugees since at least 2015, documenting a sustained Pakistani campaign to force Afghans to leave. Many of these refugees are longtime residents of Pakistan, with strong ethnic ties to Pashtun tribes living on both sides of the Durand Line. Forcing them to return to Afghanistan while the Taliban continue their insurgency places enormous strains on the Afghan government's ability to accommodate internally displaced persons. The displaced Afghans crowding refugee camps inside Afghanistan become easy recruitment prospects for the Taliban. Some multinational forums of late have made recent efforts at resolution. The Heart of Asia Istanbul process, multilateral dialogue, has tried for years to address underdevelopment in Afghanistan by enticing its neighbors to collaborate on trade and investment. The participating nations have made little progress to date because of the continuing civil war in Afghanistan. The most high-profile development projects discussed at the Heart of Asia conferences cannot proceed while the Taliban insurgency threatens areas where those projects must build or operate infrastructure. The proposed TAPI pipeline to transport Turkmenistan's natural gas through Afghanistan and Pakistan into India is one instructive example. The TAPI pipeline's route runs through parts of southern Afghanistan, particularly Gureshk district in southern Helmand province, that the Taliban actively contest. It cannot be built until the Afghan government establishes route security through Helmand and Kandahar. Another joint effort of the U.S., China, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, called the Quadrilateral Coordination Group, QCG, grew out of the Heart of Asia Conference in January 2016, specifically to foster an Afghan-led peace and reconciliation process. The Taliban have rejected the QCG's invitation to resume peace talks in Doha. Recent Taliban battlefield successes embolden them to continue rebuffing such invitations to come to Qatar. Other multilateral mechanisms have not fared much better. Afghanistan, China, Pakistan, and Tajikistan established a Quadrilateral Cooperation and Coordination Mechanism, QCCM, in counterterrorism in August 2016 that has done little to stop terrorist movements from crossing Afghanistan's borders. I suspect that the QCCM may be little more than a pretext for China to gradually extend its military presence throughout Central Asia as it builds its One Belt, One Road infrastructure projects. So let's make some new policy recommendations. SIGAR has made extensive recommendations for improving the governance of the U.S. portion of the NATO training mission. Anthony Cordesman, a distinguished policy analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, in Washington, D.C., has independently reached complementary policy recommendations. You're free to read them online. I have my own suggestions supporting their ideas. I agree that the U.S. must reprioritize its assistance to the Afghan government and military, eliminating corruption within the Afghan government, which President Ashraf Ghani himself admitted is as dangerous to Afghanistan as the Taliban, should be the top U.S. assistance priority. Setting a conditions-based approach for assistance will establish firm milestones that the Afghan government must meet to receive further aid. The international community's open-ended commitment up to now has engorged the Afghan government with aid that it has never developed the capacity to appropriately manage. Further aid must be contingent on building managerial and auditing capacity that will raise Afghanistan's capability to fight government corruption. I will go farther than the SIGAR and CSIS recommendations into a needed change in military operations. I believe that the U.S. should place the Taliban's Quetta Shura and Haqqani Network on the State Department's list of designated terrorist organizations. This will strengthen the U.S.'s whole-of-government approach to cutting off the Taliban's diplomatic and financial support from outside Afghanistan. More importantly, it signals that the U.S. considers the Taliban to be a belligerent party whose leaders and fighters are eligible to be killed. Pretending that the Taliban want to negotiate in good faith has never paid dividends for the U.S. or Afghanistan. The Taliban only understand the language of violence. Their primary militant arm, the Haqqani Network, understands both violence and criminality. Targeting these belligerents with the full range of U.S. military might and soft power capabilities is worth a change in semantics. Now here are my broader strategy recommendations. I believe that the U.S. must take a harder line with Pakistan. The Pakistani government's tolerance for the presence of anti-Afghan violent groups inside its territory has become an intolerable condition for the people of Afghanistan. The U.S. can take the following measures to weaken Pakistan's disruptive influence in Afghanistan. First, the U.S. should immediately suspend all military and economic aid programs to Pakistan. The Pakistani military is incapable of compartmentalizing our aid into campaigns that curtail Taliban influence in the country's Pashtun tribal areas. Termination of aid will compel them to reconsider their military strategy of using Afghanistan as an extension of their strategic standoff with India. Secondly, the U.S. should adapt the successful methods used to negotiate the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, to curtail Iran's nuclear program, into a negotiating stance aimed at changing Pakistan's behavior. The same negotiating parties that faced off with Iran, namely the P5 plus 1 plus EU side, should conduct the negotiations on behalf of the UN Security Council. The Security Council's approval is instrumental in applying the force of international law to Pakistan, especially since UN Security Council Resolution 2189 approved the NATO Resolute Support mission and has no expiration date. Furthermore, UN Security Council Resolution 2344 governs the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, or UNAMA, through March of 2018. The UN remains, therefore, committed to Afghanistan. Additionally, The U.S. should announce the re-implementation of the economic sanctions it emplaced in the 1970s when Pakistan began pursuing its nuclear program. The difference this time is that sanctions will not be aimed at ending Pakistan's nuclear program, which Islamabad now views as a guarantor of national survival. U.S. objectives with a new round of sanctions should remain focused on ending Pakistani support for anti-Afghan Taliban forces within its own territory. The U.S. should also expel Pakistan from the SWIFT financial transfer system and sequester Pakistani state-owned assets held in U.S.-based financial institutions. Successful resolution of the proposed P5 plus 1 EU talks will result in the lifting of these hypothetical, for the moment, sanctions. The required precursors to taking all of these very severe actions would be the termination of Pakistan's status as a major non-NATO ally of the U.S., and declaring Pakistan to be a state sponsor of terrorism. Terminating Pakistan's treatment as a U.S. ally would prevent it from participating in certain U.S. counterterrorism initiatives and end its ability to purchase or possess U.S. military equipment. Officially identifying Pakistan's sponsorship of terrorism opens the door to financial sanctions and trade embargoes under U.S. law. It is only fair to end this set of military and diplomatic privileges, since Pakistan's duplicitous tolerance for violent organizations that sometimes endanger U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan is not behavior becoming an ally anyway. Ending Pakistan's status as a U.S. ally means ending the transit of U.S. and NATO military materiel through Pakistan's territory, along with overflight rights for military aircraft. Opening an alternative ground line of communications supporting the NATO military effort in Afghanistan is a prerequisite for even considering these actions against Pakistan. The Northern Logistics Corridor into Afghanistan that NATO had developed is no longer an option given Russia's severely adversarial stance toward the U.S. and NATO. The only viable alternative would be a potential ground route from Iran's port at Chabahar into western Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the U.S. does not presently maintain diplomatic relations with Iran, but perhaps that should change. A diplomatic rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran is a further prerequisite for such a tilt away from Pakistan. A resumption of U.S.-Iran diplomatic relations would send a strong signal to Islamabad that the U.S. is preparing strategic options that will negate Pakistan's influence in Central Asia. One final lever the U.S. can use to push Pakistan in the right direction is the developing U.S.-India relationship. The U.S. has clearly begun a strategic tilt towards India with increased military-to-military contacts and sales of advanced weaponry. The U.S. can go farther with calculated pro-India moves. For example, declaring support for Indian control of Pakistan's claims to disputed areas in Kashmir. Denying Pakistan strategic freedom of movement in such a contested area will pressure Islamabad to concede influence in other areas, namely Afghanistan. The U.S. should also consider sharing intelligence with India that would give it a decisive advantage in any future conflict with Pakistan, with particular emphasis on mitigating Pakistan's nuclear capabilities. Inducing panic in Islamabad over the possibility of losing its strategic nuclear deterrent in a crisis would properly focus Pakistani attention on the importance of leaving Afghanistan alone. So in conclusion, the road to peace in Afghanistan is still a road to nowhere for the time being. There is no end in sight to the fighting after over 15 years of U.S.-led military and diplomatic intervention. Afghanistan has plenty of problems to solve, and international help since the end of the Taliban regime has facilitated only minimal progress. Adopting long-overdue reforms to U.S. policy would impart a conditions-based approach to the NATO-led advisory mission that has been lacking up until now. However, a conditions-based aid and advisory approach is insufficient to stabilize Afghanistan as long as Pakistan exports its most destabilizing influences across the border. Tightening the screws on Pakistan with hard diplomatic approaches and leveraging a new U.S. strategic approach toward both Iran and India is absolutely an imperative if the international community is serious about resolving Afghanistan. Thank you.
Thanks to Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Alfidi for his comments. Now it's time for the question and answer period. Again, I'm Aisha Wahab, today's moderator. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. As a quick reminder, we'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Resolving Afghanistan and Crafting a Sensible U.S. Approach with Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Alfidi. So let us begin some of the questions.
All right.
You spoke about the corruption in Afghanistan. However, do you believe the corruption in large part is due to the fact that the U.S. did not push to remove all the warlords and instead put them in power in the current and previous administration, therefore legitimizing their power?
That's a valid point. Early on in the U.S. and NATO intervention in Afghanistan, we relied heavily on warlords to incorporate them into the power structure of the Afghan government, assuming that they would be able to clean up their act and play responsible roles. Some of them have cleaned up their act, some of them have not. One who is obviously a recidivist is First Vice President Rashid Dostum. He was accused last year of raping a political ally and he was accused of allowing his bodyguards to rape a political ally, and he has since sequestered himself in his compound in Kabul, surrounded by multiple armed bodyguards. And the Afghan government has been dragging its heels to apprehend him, to investigate him, to bring him to justice. I think a lot of Afghans who've had experience up to now in the decades of international intervention in the country are growing frustrated with the Afghan government's inability to turn out these warlords and make them either change or remove them from the government.
Speaking of warlords currently in power, it's historically known that each one of these warlords, whether you mention Dostum, whether you mention technically Abdullah Abdullah of the Northern Alliance, if you consider him a warlord, as well as the return of Ekhmatyar, they currently all have their own private soldiers that are loyal to them and have historically been loyal to them. How does that play into Ghani's potential control?
It's interesting because the Afghan government has tried over the years to incorporate some of these militias into an official Afghan governing structure. The latest program to make this attempt is the Afghan Local Police, ALP. It was designed to recruit as many of these warlord-controlled militias as possible and put them in uniform and give them official government sanction to perform local duties near their homelands, their villages. And it's had mixed success. I think there was a SIGAR report on this about 3 or 4 months ago detailing U.S. funding for this program. It's had some success in some areas. It's not a ringing success because the ALP, in the tradition of their warlord-controlled predecessors, are prone to corruption. They're prone to abandoning their duties. It's not a complete success story.
You specifically mentioned Dostum as being accused of rape and not being able to bring him to maybe a trial or some type of justice. Mm-hmm. It's well known for almost the last 40 years that each one of these individuals that either serve as a minister or a member of parliament or any of these high ranks, including Ekhmatyar, including members of the Northern Alliance, including members of the Taliban, have committed human rights violations. It has been documented historically for many, many years. Why do you think that the most current action of Dostum is more important to bring to justice than any of the previous actions that have historically taken place?
It's more important because of his high visibility. He is the first vice president, and he was recruited into the National Unity Government specifically because of his strength among the Uzbek populations in the north. Mm-hmm. That's his base of support. Because his name recognition as a participant in this government signifies to all Afghans, in theory, that all Afghan factions and ethnic groups should participate in the government.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
When we speak about justice for the Afghan people, historically, we've in the past recent years, we've actually had a young woman named Farhanda, who was wrongfully accused of burning the holy book, the Quran Sharif. And she was beaten. She was lit on fire. And she was ran over with a vehicle by hundreds of men. And at the same time, there has not been a single individual that is serving a life sentence or has received a death sentence. What do you think that impact has on the state of women's rights?
It's a very depressing impact because given that there has been some progress in women's rights in Afghanistan, it's undeniable when you look at the presence of women in the Afghan government, elected to the Loya Jirga, appointed to ministerial positions. It's really disheartening to see one step forward, 10 steps backward whenever atrocities like that are committed against women. There was a silver lining to one incident that happened, I think about a year, year and a half ago, when a woman was murdered and there were protests in the capital of Kabul demanding that the perpetrators who murdered her were brought to justice. There needs to be more of that. More Afghans, especially more Afghan men, need to speak out, need to exhibit their frustration and intolerance for the poor treatment of women and the inability of the Afghan government to support women's rights.
The event that you spoke about the protests in Afghanistan was specifically for Farhanda.
Oh, that one? Okay, yes. That's the one. I didn't recall the name. Okay.
What do you think are the mistakes of the United States in Afghanistan from the beginning to the end? And you can group them in, you know, three prongs or...
Tons of mistakes. Where do I begin? Number one, the failure to hold Pakistan to account, which primarily is a result of our early reliance. We had to rely on Pakistan for the transport of military goods from Pakistan's port through up through the tribal areas of Pakistan, through the Khyber Pass, and into Afghanistan. That was the only reliable ground route for bringing U.S. and allied military material into the country. We relied on that too much. We considered the alternative of the Northern Distribution Network too late in the campaign. So late, in fact, that it's questionable as to whether it made a difference. A big mistake in governance is to tolerate the Afghan, specifically the Karzai administration's reliance upon warlords and incorporating too many unreliable warlords into the government who did not change their ways. Big mistake is lack of monitoring of the funds spent early on reconstruction, on humanitarian assistance. A lot of the money spent, as detailed by numerous SIGAR reports going back years, ended up in the pockets of warlords, ended up misspent, ended up in the hands of the Taliban, who leveraged their corrupt connections with the government and with others to steal money, to steal equipment. Where do we end? Where does the mistaken approach end?
With Mullah Omar being identified as killed, why do you think that the Taliban still has a growing power, a growing number of backers and support, with Ikhmatyar Gulbuddin coming into Afghanistan and having his faction of Hizb-e-Islami in Afghanistan that still, as he speaks very peacefully, there is a small faction of his that still says that we're ready?
Yeah, factionalization of that nature is just part and parcel of Afghan politics, Afghan history. As encouraging as it is to see Mr. Hikmatyar reach an agreement with the Afghan government to have his troops lay down their weapons and reintegrate into society and support the government, there's always some tribal-based faction, some sub-tribal faction that isn't going to go along with that. I think going back to the first part of that question about why are the Taliban able to generate power, able to maintain their appeal, the Taliban have one salient advantage in their ideology that the Afghan government does not have. The Taliban ideology is a combination of Pashtun nationalism and Diobandi theology. Diobandi is a subset of the Hanafi school of Sunni Islam, founded in Dioband, India, I believe in the 19th century. That is a very virulent, very militant strain of Sunni Islam that enables their recruitment campaigns, that enables their ideological cohesion together with Pashtun nationalism, the dream of a unified Pashtun state straddling the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. That imaginary appeal, whatever you want to call it, is so compelling to disaffected Pashtuns who have no job prospects, who've been cut off from their local village because they emigrated to Pakistan to work for a whole host of reasons. That's an enormous advantage that the Afghan government has not been able to counter.
So just for historical references, the country of Afghanistan has never historically had a very strong army. So even right now, the amount of money that the United States is spending on the Afghan army to defend themselves against Pakistan, for many Afghans, it's almost laughable, and it's almost a waste of money for the United States, specifically regarding several other tactics in U.S. military. With the Taliban growing, and yes, you know, in regards to the power and the dominance that they show in fighting is one thing. However, what do you know about the Taliban's original support when they first started?
There has always been something in Afghan history that engenders movements like the Taliban. The tribal areas in Pakistan, for example, used to be part of the Durrani Empire in the 18th century when Afghanistan was much larger. And I would say there's always been something present in Afghan society that allows for the coalescence of violent groups like that.
I'd like to add to your point of when the Taliban first came about, it was, and this is a story that's often told, is that it was due to the fact that during the civil war, men, women, and children were being raped, and there was a woman who escaped and came to Mullah Omar's specific mosque, and that's when the Taliban was born. Oh. That's one of the folklores.
Okay.
One of the questions I have is that in the mid-90s, the Taliban gained support and gained control about roughly 95% of the country. Mm. And it was primarily known to be as safe as can be, one. Number two, it was stated that the Taliban were very, very much anti-opium trade. And prior to 9/11, there was very minimal opium trade. And at the same time, currently, with the opium trade rising significantly with U.S. involvement. What do you consider about that?
It's interesting because, yes, it is true that during the Taliban regime, opium production dropped to just about zero. But so did human freedom. So did the opportunities for women. Women were considered property and confined to the home. So did artistic expression. The Taliban destroyed the Bamiyan Buddhas to thumb their nose at the international community. I don't think a trade-off would be acceptable. And I think the recent polls conducted by the Asia Foundation of Afghan popular opinion support a lack of desire to go back to the Taliban's bad old days of governance. I don't think anybody wants to return to that kind of regime.
One of the questions we have is that with us allying ourselves with Pakistan, as well as questionable characters like Iran, do you think that we can partner with the Taliban?
No, absolutely not.
Why not?
The Taliban will lie, cheat, and steal to get their way. The Taliban's overtures to the negotiations, the so-called peace negotiations in Qatar, were nothing more than a ruse on their part to buy time while they could rebuild combat power. They will use any trick in the book to deceive the West. It's typical of their quote-unquote diplomatic stance. They're not trustworthy, no. Yeah, even in recent years, they've tried to proclaim themselves as reformed, that they're willing to accept limited understandings of women's rights. Their behavior does not bear that out.
Do you believe that... I'm sorry, we're getting a lot of random questions.
Go ahead.
Do you believe that the Taliban are divided in factions just as every other warlord group is?
Yes, they are. It's hard to understand how to keep them fractured and divided against themselves if we don't have a deep understanding of the sociological, the demographic patchwork of tribes in Afghanistan. For example, the Quetta Shura, the leadership of the Quetta Shura has predominantly been southern Kandahari from the Durrani tribes, and I think from other sub-tribes as well. But in order to have credibility with the lead element of the Taliban, you have to be Kandahari in origin. So leveraging other tribes that are rivals to the Durranis, I think the Popo Zais were Amadkar Zais tribe might be a way to do that. But to the extent that we haven't done that is an ignorance on the part of the West that that's inexcusable given our years of history in Afghanistan.
What did the mother of all bombs dropped on Afghanistan achieve?
I think it achieved three different objectives at the tactical, operational, and strategic level. At the tactical level, it broke up a hornet's nest of bunkers and defensive positions that needed to be broken up and could not, and that the Afghan army did not have the capability to break up on its own with a ground assault. From an operational standpoint, it disrupted ISIS's ability to operate in that area and drove them out, hopefully somewhere else. I haven't seen the AAR because it's classified, but I certainly wouldn't reveal it here. And from a strategic standpoint, it demonstrates to ISIS and other factions that are fighting there that we are willing to use anything with an explosive yield up to something just south of a tactical nuke to get our way.
One of the questions we have is, no occupying power has ever managed to control Afghanistan. Ask the British and the Russians. Mm-hmm. Why should the current occupying power, which has been there for the past 15 plus years, be any different?
We've proven that we're not any different. We've proven that we're not able to understand or control Afghanistan. I think the best we can do is facilitate their growth and step back and not try to be an occupying power. If Afghanistan wants to westernize and develop, it will do so in their own time. And they'll follow their own path.
Yeah. Recently, a Fox News program interviewed the founder of Blackwater, who proposed a model from the British colonial era wherein the East Indian Company was utilized more than the British military. Since the Trump team listens to Fox, will this model be possible in Afghanistan?
No, he's nuts. No. Eric Prince's latest venture is to contract with the Chinese government in Xinjiang to supply them with mercenaries, and I don't exactly know why he's doing that. But if he's trying to extend his business venture into Afghanistan, it won't work. I don't think Western-backed mercenaries are going to be effective there. No. He's looking to make money. He shouldn't be doing that. No.
Speaking of China, what do you think the impact is for Afghanistan not being included as part of the Chinese initiative of the modern Silk Road and instead Pakistan?
I think it's a recognition that China understands its limitations in extending power into an area that I don't think it's ever controlled. I don't think imperialist Chinese throughout the centuries, military adventures have ever extended into Afghanistan. And the Hindu Kush Mountains are certainly an important barrier to that. I think China's main interest with Pakistan is building the China-Pakistan economic corridor that will increase the flow of goods from Pakistan's southern ports into China proper. And I think that to the extent that China worries about Afghanistan, it's concerned that its own Islamic separatist movements in the Xinjiang region, the only Muslim-majority province of Afghanistan. Specifically, there's an East Turkestan Islamic movement, East Turkestan independence movement that's trying to carve out an Islamic niche within China. China is worried about that particular movement communicating or receiving funding or exchanging any kind of tactics with fighters elsewhere in Central Asia, including in Afghanistan. So China certainly does not want Afghanistan's problems to bleed into China and wants to contain its own insurgency within Xinjiang.
Do you believe that ISIS Khorasan, the Afghan faction of ISIS, its main goal is to spread into China and Russia to destabilize those regions as part of U.S.'s larger military tactic?
That's certainly an ambitious goal for IS Khorasan, given the fact that they're very small and that they're under pressure from both the U.S. and the Afghan government and the Taliban, who disagree with them in theological terms. It's a bit of a stretch to say that IS has the capability to reach into those countries. They certainly recruit from every country, including Russia. I don't know if they recruit from China. I would say that at the present time they're not much of a threat to the larger countries of Central Asia. They're more of a nuisance.
Okay. Given the Iranian government Shia leadership, why do you entertain any hope of U.S. improving relations?
First of all, the initiation of the JCPOA, the Agreement to Control Iran's Nuclear Ambitions, allows an avenue for international inspectors, specifically the UN's Atomic Energy Agency, to represent themselves as representatives of the international community monitoring Iran's activities. There's an opening there. The second opening is the potential results of this week's elections if more reformers are elected to positions of authority in Iran. I realize that Iran is not completely a republic because the mullahs are still in charge. But perhaps when the generation of mullahs that survived the Iranian Revolution of 1979 passes from the scene and younger reformers are elected to office, there will be a potential lever there that the U.S. can exploit as an introduction.
Moving on to the people of Afghanistan, mm-hmm. What do you think the Afghan people want from us?
I think they just want to be left alone. The urban elites in places like Kabul and Mazar-i-Sharif have extensive contacts with the West after years of dealing with coalition forces, years of receiving international donor aid. They're still willing to face the world. But the rest of Afghanistan is still locked in the 10th century or 11th century. Many places in rural Afghanistan don't even tell time, don't follow a calendar. Don't recognize Westerners. I've read anecdotal stories of U.S. troops that entered villages in remote parts of Afghanistan, and the villagers would ask them, "Are you Russian? Is the Russian occupation over?" Are they, you know, this is decades after the Soviets left, and they're not ready to face the world. They would just rather continue living their medieval lifestyle indefinitely.
What do you think about the Afghan refugees, both in Pakistan, Iran, and abroad?
I'd like to see them repatriated in a way that is not stressful to Afghan society. I'd like to see the international community through the UN's various relief agencies pay closer attention to Afghan refugees. I think the tragedy of what's happening in Syria and Iraq right now with so many Syrian refugees fleeing into Europe is that has become the focus of the international community. And perhaps it should because of the stress on Syrian society there. But it tempts us to ignore tragedies that unfold in other parts of the world, including Afghanistan. We can't lose sight of the fact that Afghan refugees in Iran and other countries are human beings too and deserve fair treatment from their host countries and deserve to be repatriated into lifestyles where they can be reintegrated into Afghan society. We owe them that.
Do you believe that it's our doing as for the reason why so many refugees across the country and across the world have been fleeing their homes?
If I had an answer to that, I'd be the UN Secretary General, and I'm not qualified. I think it differs by region, differs by nation. Collapse in governance in places like Syria certainly feeds a refugee problem. Can't speak for places like sub-Saharan Africa, where I'm sure that's a problem too. Can't speak for South Sudan. Every country is different.
With the majority of the Afghan population being 30 or under, what do you have as a hope for the Afghan younger generation?
I would hope that they can engage in business activities, if they can't find conventional employment, that are consistent with Afghan cultural norms, that can be financed through Afghan scale projects. I'm encouraged by the microfinance revolution. Because of Afghanistan's lack of a conventional banking system that we understand in the West, they have to rely on traditional things like hawala transfers. And I think the innovation of microfinance from institutions like the Grameen Bank enable small-scale projects that villages can approve and build themselves, things that are not subject to Western strictures, Western styles of governance would probably work at that level. That would provide employment for Afghans.
With President Ghani's recent initiative to bring in more foreign-born Afghans to support his modernization of Afghanistan, what do you think are the pros and cons of that?
The pros are they get capital. I think it's instructive to look at the Afghan community here in the Bay Area, which I think is one of the largest Afghan expatriate communities in the world. They've succeeded in Silicon Valley. They have money. and some of the earliest entrepreneurs who returned to Afghanistan after the Taliban were evicted in 2001 were Afghan Americans who brought money from America and built up some of the television networks, some of the Wi-Fi communications networks. So they have the ability to bring money, bring entrepreneurial energy and experience and connections with the West. The cons, they may be perceived by more traditional Afghans as interlopers, as people who've been absent for decades, begging the question, where were you when we had to fight the Taliban all by ourselves? Now you're coming in with money, okay. But on balance, I think it would be a net positive for Afghans to engage the Afghan expatriate community worldwide, not just in the U.S., to bring money back to their home country.
With the United States having less women being represented in government, in elected capacity, and the Afghanistan having more women in official elected capacity, who are we to judge women's rights in Afghanistan? What do you think about that?
Ironic, isn't it? That they, I don't know if the number is higher in raw numbers or proportionally. I don't know what the measurement is, but it's encouraging to see Afghans make progress in that simple metric. I think that it would be more encouraging to look at broader applications of things like the UN Declaration on Universal Human Rights, where we could judge a society whether they're adhering to things like that are accepted as global standards and global norms. So is the U.S. doing a better job at adhering to global standards of human rights? I would say on balance, yes. Could Afghan do better? Could Afghanistan do better in that regard? Certainly, yes.
What do you think about so far of President Ghani's successes and failures, as it's not really been mentioned in the media as of late?
I think he's been successful in holding together a very fractious national unity government. I think balancing the spinning plates of the needs of Hazaras, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Pashtuns, and every other ethnic group that's present in the country is an amazing feat. I think the con of that is because he's concerned about stressing the government, he's so far been unwilling to stress it by testing, for example, the Dostum case, by bringing Dostum to investigation and trial for fear of upsetting the Uzbek community. I think having an extraordinarily weak government like that, where he feels that he has to bend over backwards to accommodate Uzbeks or Pashtuns or whoever, is a severe risk that he's been managing so far. But there's no assurance that he'll be able to continue.
You mentioned earlier about catering to whether it be Pashtuns, Uzbeks, Azoras, or whoever else. Do you believe that tension is propagated also primarily because of the fact that we have a Afghan president and an Afghan CEO? And what was the thought process behind putting a CEO with a president of a country?
The thought process was, as a result of the 2014 elections, where there were questions about the validity of some of the ballots, it was an uneasy compromise to allow an extra constitutional arrangement of the CEO, where Abdullah could represent the he's Uzbek, right?
Or Tajik.
He's Tajik. I'm sorry, he's Tajik. Where he could represent that faction without a potential for violence. It's one of those situations where the U.S., through its foreign policy, has reached an accommodation with a client state that does not necessarily comport with the highest aspirations of American values or democratic values. But it may have been necessary at the time. The only hope in justifying a compromise like that is going forward, if the next round of elections could be monitored more closely, could be perceived by the world community as more fair.
Do you believe by doing this, Secretary of State John Kerry, as well as the United States, perpetuated and delayed a inevitable civil war?
I wouldn't call it inevitable. I would say the civil war has been raging for the better part of 30 years now, instigated by the Soviets and the Soviet invasion, and continuing through the Taliban regime, continuing now through the West occupation of the country. The civil war never really ended. It's changed forms. It's changed in intensity. But because 30 years of nonstop conflict have shredded national institutions in Afghanistan, it's hard to say what's inevitable about something that's been continuing for such a long time.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question. And the question we have here is, does the expenditure of Western NATO money help, or is all this violence the consequence of such so-called support? Should we be there at all?
Yes, we should. We should be there because Afghanistan is an excellent case of how the international community can take responsibility for a country that has been a cradle of violence against its neighbors and against the West with the 9/11 attacks. I think that making the aid conditions based is an important innovation, something we need to do. We can't be an open-ended spigot of funds that undeveloped countries can use to their heart's content. But we do need to be there. We need to be there because the Afghan people deserve a government that reflects the best aspirations of their culture. They deserve a government that comports with international norms in fairness and honesty and transparency, and they deserve to have a good life. We can still provide that for them with the advice and mentoring and military support we give the Afghans.
Thanks to our distinguished speaker, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Alfidi. We appreciate your appearance and your answering our questions. We also thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Aisha Wahab, your moderator for today's program, Resolving Afghanistan and Crafting a Sensible U.S. Approach. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating our over 113 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.